If I had to think of a time I personally smelled my worst, it would have to be after one of Jay's concerts, an outside concert at that. My right armpit was ripe for the pickings, smelled like beef stroganoff. I kid you not, it was rancid. As a special offer, new customers get 15% off all Lumi products with our exclusive code and link. Use code BUNNY, B-U-N-N-I-E, at LumiDeodorant.com. And that's LumiDeodorant.com. I personally freaking love Lumi. I have every scent. My favorite one is the toasted coconut, though, because even when you sweat, it still smells so good and so yummy, and you feel like you're on a tropical island. But I promise you guys, any sort of smells you could possibly have, Lumi will cover it up. Once again, as a special offer for listeners, new customers get 15% off all Lumi products with our exclusive code. And if you combine the 15% off with the already discounted starter pack, that equals over 40% off their starter pack. Use code BUNNY, B-U-N-N-I-E, for 15% off your first purchase at LumiDeodorant.com. That's code BUNNY, B-U-N-N-I-E, at LumiDeodorant.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What's up, guys? Don't forget to sub to Patreon so that you can see the visuals. Because not only do we have episodes of the podcast, we have exclusive content that nobody else sees on any other apps, behind the scenes, photo shoots, and we're dropping a whole bunch of surprising stuff this year. So if you guys don't want to miss out and you want to be the first to know, go over to our Patreon, www.dumbblondeunrated.com. Love ya. Is this thing on?
All right, gentlemen, coming to main stage next, this is Bunny. Get up there. She's got a tornado of titties coming your way. Get those dollar bills ready. She's got an ass that shakes like Michael J. Fox. So get up there and throw them dollars.
Dude, that is fucking iconic. What's up, you sexy motherfuckers? Welcome to another episode of Dumb Blonde. Today, my Bubba, our Bubba, our family lovingly calls him Bubba, is in the house today. But you guys might know him as one of the bad boys of country, Mr. Brantley Gilbert. What's up?
What's going on, fam?
How you doing?
I'm good. I like the setup here. This is going to be good.
Oh, we got to get you to sign the wall. Everybody that is on the podcast signs the wall.
That I can do.
Yeah. What are you guys doing in Nashville?
So we came up, had some studio stuff to do. I actually got a studio put in my bus that'll work at home, and it'll nice. Kind of allow me to write with guys in Nashville and do studio work at home. And my producer, Brock, can actually, the program we're using, he can use my screen and basically run my screen and run Pro Tools and everything from Nashville while I'm sitting in Georgia recording. So
wow.
It'll save me some time, give me some more time at home with the kids and the wife.
Ah, kids and wives. Shout out Amber. We love you. She's such a hottie, dude.
My wife is bad, son.
Dude, that body, like, come on. And she's so shy about it, too. So I'm like, it just makes me want to see more.
Oh, you and me both. I'm telling you, I chased my wife around the house like a pit bull with a red thing hanging out.
Yeah, oh, I love that, though. She's so cute. You guys are adorable. We're going to get into your story in a little bit. But I did a ton of research on you last night, and I learned so much really cool stuff about you that I never even knew. And I'm, like, super excited for my fan base to learn that about you if they don't know it already, because some of this shit's, like, really fucking cool.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Well, let's take it back. So you were born in Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
Grew up in Georgia. And I read that your dad was a pastor.
Yeah. So my dad and mom met at a Bible college in Knoxville, Tennessee. My mom was raised in Indiana. My dad was raised home in Georgia, where we live now. And they met there. If you met my dad, you wouldn't in a million years think that at one point he was a pastor.
Really? Is he wild like you?
Oh, he's yeah, he can be a little wild. He's settled down though. In the last few years he remarried, and we love his wife. Her name's Cresha, and she is just the sweetest woman ever. He married really well. We love her to death, but
he
put the bottle down too. So he and I both had a little bit of some bouts with drinking and stuff. But he's
was that before
I think he's
he
five
became
or 6 years.
A pastor or after the drinking?
I would imagine both.
Oh,
if
wow,
I had to
okay
guess, my memory's a little hazy, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But I think it was something he was working at. I bought a farm in Alabama mm-hmm at one point that I had for about 10 years. And for most of that time, he was kind of living there, running that farm for me. And it was in the middle. It was between Eufaula and Phoenix City and this little town called Pittsview. And there's literally nothing there but Mead Paper Company. I mean, there's just nothing happening. And I think a lot of it was out of boredom, you know.
Right.
But yeah, he's a good time, man. Anybody knows my dad will tell you, he's funny as hell. And he's a trip.
I feel like we need more people like that that are pastors, that are sinners too, and that don't try to be like holier than thou and try to like pretend that their life's perfect. Like, I feel like people can relate to people who actually slip up and make mistakes and admit to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, I love
that. I trust is hard to come by for me, but me and your husband were talking about this the other day. If I'm messing with somebody and they don't have at least one vice, if somebody's too squeaky clean,
right,
I'm definitely not trusting you.
Yeah,
you
no,
have
for
nothing
sure
on your record. You've never been to rehab, prison, or war.
Yeah,
I'm not going to trust you with much, nothing.
No, I totally understand that. Except for women, we can't do prison and war, right? You don't want your bitches going to prison.
No,
being old war whores.
I don't think my wife would fare well in prison. Well, I don't know. She's tough. She is, because you know my wife's got the little cute innocent looking thing going on, but I'll tell you what, my wife is a gangster. She don't play.
Oh no, she doesn't give off. Like, she's very a hard egg to crack, that's
yeah,
for sure. Yeah,
for sure.
She gives off the vibe of like fuck around and find out.
Yeah, and she don't pull no punches with me, I can promise you.
I love that.
Yeah, she's tough. But that, you know what, I think that's one of the million reasons that I love my wife the way I do. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could have married a woman that wasn't strong and hard-headed and stubborn, because
absolutely
I am too. But I think both of us are there's two alphas running around in that house.
Oh yeah, same with Jay and I, so I get it. I love that you and Jay are the same way how he is with me, like how you are with your wife. I think that's just amazing, because a lot of men, especially because you're like considered a sex symbol pretty much, you know, so they want to he's like, what do I wear to the podcast? I was like, well, you should take your shirt off, because all the ladies would love that, you know. But no, you're like considered a sex symbol, so in the industry it's very rare to find men who have that kind of like, you know, ambiance to them and are still just so proud of their wives and so proud to be married and just always upping their wives. So I love that about you.
For sure. I'll tell you, with my wife, I mean, you mentioned it, she is hot as fire. And I'm telling you, from the first time I saw her, she's drop dead gorgeous. But man, she works hard to be that way too. Like, she is
in the gym.
She's putting in work. I mean, it's hard work there. But man, when I really think about, you know, my wife and what her strengths are, like, I've never seen a better mom. Like, aww, you know, she, my mom is she's my other, I got three angels, and that's, you know, I guess four with my son, but my mom and my wife and my two babies. And, you know, my mom's an incredible mom, but Amber's a freaking rock star, dude. Doing what I do for a living, being gone the way I am, and even when I'm home, man, sometimes I struggle to detach and kind of leave the road on the road, and
right,
and vice versa. Because for so long, this wasn't ever really a job for me. It was life.
Right.
It's all I know. From, you know, when I look back, the only fluid memory I have of life is being on 3-4 days a week minimum, home 3 or 4, and you know, having some brief breaks, but really just grinding it out. And when I was single, I really didn't ever come home. I built a house in my hometown. I just wanted to put a double wide on this little piece of property that I bought. But
I think I read somewhere that you actually bought that property because you and Amber broke up. And it was right down the street from her mom's house.
It's 3 minutes from her mom.
He didn't say no, ladies and gentlemen.
I wanted to put a double wide on it. And my manager and business manager talked me into building a house. And you know, I kind of looked at it and I was like, well, if I'm building a house, I'm gonna make damn sure she has to pass it every time she comes home from college and comes home from Savannah or whatever. Like, I want her to have to drive by that son of a gun and be like, hmm. I really wasn't fair. You know, my wife and I, we've got a long history, but we went 5 years without seeing or speaking to each other. And
yeah, let's rewind real quick, because you talk about your mom being your angel. Let's rewind it back to childhood really quick. I did read an article where you said that you did start writing music at age 13. Was that inspired by your parents? Did you grow up in a musical household? Like, or how did you know that you wanted to, like, write music and be a musician?
I remember my mom singing in church. It used to kill me because she sang so loud, but she sings like a bird. In her side of the family, my grandfather was in a military band in the Navy, and several of her brothers pick and grin. And so I think that's probably the musical side of the family.
Just in your blood.
Mm-hmm. But it was strange for me starting out. A lot of people, when they start learning guitar, they start learning other people's songs. And that was something that I did in the very beginning. But I always had this thing where I just wanted to do my own.
Right.
Like, being able to play somebody else's song was cool, and you could pull it out at parties, and, you know, you had your girl getters and everything else. But for whatever reason, groupies. I always just felt like, you know, I wanted to write my own songs. And that was from what I remember, from what my mom says, it started at a very early age. She said, I used to have a little plastic guitar, and I'd put on shows for an audience of one in my room and stuff. I don't remember any of that.
Yeah. So I know people are going to hear you say that you don't remember a lot of your childhood. And that's because you got into, like, almost a near fatal accident when you were 19.
Yeah, I think 19, 20, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
It was 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And there's, you know, if you go around my hometown and listen to different people tell the story, I mean, there's some urban legend to it. I feel like I look at some of the things that were said about it looking back, and I couldn't tell you if they're true or not. It was one guy said I landed on my feet or something. And
were you drunk driving?
I probably would not. As far as the state of Georgia is concerned, absolutely not. It was just a reckless driving charge. I was driving recklessly. But no, I to be completely honest, it was 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. There had been a party the night before, and I had a little bit of an altercation with one of my best friends in the world. And I was on my way. He tells the story a lot better than I do, but I guess he might have been, you know, we were making some bad choices back in the day, and he might have been harboring something that I wanted, and he wouldn't give it to me, and didn't want me to have my keys. And apparently I ran him out of his own house, and I had a feeling I knew where he was going, so I was headed where he went, and I never made it. But it was wild, because it was on the road you have to take in my hometown to get to the church I grew up in. And it was like 8 o'clock, everybody and their brothers driving by, and I had, you know, a case of beer in the truck, I guess. There's beer spread all over the road. The one thing I do remember of it is it's so strange looking back, is it's not like I've been diagnosed with this, that, or other. But, you know, I'll sit around, and a lot of times when I'm talking with my friends or family, you know, they'll talk about things that they remember so vividly, and it's like they're telling stories in detail, and I'm picking up.
It's just hard for you
really
to remember.
Bits and pieces. So I lost my train of thought.
No,
I forgot
you're
what
good.
The hell I was talking about.
Do you think growing up in a religious household kind of made you rebellious?
You know what? That's interesting. We were in church every time the doors were open, for a long time, and that was where a lot of my music started. You know, it was kind of in that environment, and something looking back I appreciate. At the same time, I do think, you know, there was a period in my life, probably early teen years, I don't remember exactly when, but I do remember going to Panama City, and I got arrested down there for one thing or another, and
I love how he never incriminates himself.
Right? To this day, buddy.
Never incriminating.
Or any of my friends. We just go to church together. We talk about Jesus.
We love Jesus.
But it's like, I do remember this. I remember coming home and people in my hometown, especially in my friend group, I guess, but you know, my friends that I was close with, we grew up playing ball together and they were good kids. I mean, we got in a little mischief, right? But right. I mean, nothing crazy, but we didn't get arrested either. Nobody went to jail, really.
Right. It was just good, clean fun.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I remember coming home and there being like this energy that I was like, bad now. You know, I was like the bad boy. Nobody got arrested. I got arrested, you know, in Panama City and then found myself in handcuffs a couple more times and it kind of turned into something that, you know how small towns work too.
Where yeah, like everybody
news
talks.
Just gets around, everybody's mm-hmm. talking, all my dirty laundry's out. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm still the same dude that grew up playing ball with y'all's kids. You know what I mean? They're still right. my buddies. I peed on a wall. I got in a fight. You know, I got caught.
Yeah.
I didn't do anything anybody else would
do. I swear that's my luck, too. I was always the bad friend. Your birthday is 2 days before mine. And I swear we're ruled by Saturn. And, like, our life is just a fucking lesson. Like,
Jelly was telling me some of that you're into that stuff. Yeah. That's pretty interesting to me.
Yeah. No, but it's so real. Like, we're ruled by just karma and rebellion. That's literally what we're ruled by. And that's why I grew up in an extremely strict Southern Pentecostal home. And I was buck wild. I left home by 14.
Yeah.
So, and I know just that tightness of religion, it kind of sometimes makes people want to go the other way. So that's why I was asking.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I definitely think that was probably a contributing factor. But I do think there was something just in my nature.
Yeah.
I mean, to this day, knowing what I know now and knowing good and damn well that most of the time I've got good people around me that can give me great advice and keep me out of shitty situations. But mm-hmm. if you tell me not to do something to this day at 38 years old, there's a damn good chance I'm going
to
do it.
Absolutely. I'm the same way. Don't tell me. If you want me to do something, tell me not to do it.
Yeah.
Literally. That will motivate me more to just do it. So let's move forward. Were you and Amber childhood sweethearts, or did you guys meet before you went to college, or how did that work?
So we met. I was actually working off some community service hours at a church that my cousin, who's also like a Christian counselor and therapist, he's an incredible man, but he was the youth pastor there. And I went in and I'd play some songs and stuff, and he'd write off all my hours. And her family went to that church. So I met her at church, but I was working Aww. Off. The reason I was there was to work off community service hours. But I remember seeing her and just being like, who's we grew up. So basically it's the same town. There's a river that divides it. There's some county schools, and then there's Jefferson and there's Commerce. And back then, Jefferson and Commerce was the most heated rivalry. If you ask anybody around our town, that was the most heated rivalry in the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. I mean, you weren't supposed to date across the river. We fought, we painted the bridge, we sabotaged each other's school. I mean, you name it.
Yeah.
It was just a heated rivalry, but there really wasn't anything between the two towns but the Oconee River,
right?
And there was a bridge that divided it, but it was a pretty heated rivalry. And I honestly didn't spend much time across the river, so to speak. But when I met her, when I saw her, like I mean, in a weird way, I remember just being like, that is one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen in my life. And she was a good bit younger than me. I had graduated. And I remember like talking on the phone with her and stuff until she was 18. And then we did the dating thing, but it was always an off and on thing,
right?
That really revolved around what kind of trouble I was in and what kind of crowd I was with at the time. And
well, you were growing up.
Yeah.
Figuring out who you were.
Yeah. And it was at that age too, man. It was when that rebellion thing really kicked in, and I'd got to the point, and there were several different chapters in my life where it was like, all right, y'all think I'm the bad boy, I'll show you bad boy, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
But I did keep some pretty rough company. I was doing some things that I knew she wasn't, like, she was raised in a really good home too, and had never been exposed to some of the things that I was around on a daily basis and some of the people that I was around on a daily basis. And I just remember it being off and on. Her mama hated me. Her daddy and I, when he was alive, I remember like showing up. They were when I was still allowed to pick her up, you know, in the early days. I would go and he'd be sitting in his chair and I'd go in and we'd chop it up and we'd talk. But when her mama walked in the room, but he closed down on me.
Does she love you now?
Her mama?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Good.
We get along pretty good, so Lily and I.
Yeah, I love that.
But it is crazy to be at that house sometimes because at one point in time, it was somewhere I wasn't welcome.
Right.
You know?
Look at the growth, though. It's right? Amazing. And you guys still stuck it out no matter what. You know, even though it was off and on, you guys had something that always brought you guys back together.
For sure.
Which brings me to, you ended up getting your bachelor's degree in relationship and marriage counseling.
Does it say that?
It does say that. And I never know what's real.
Yeah, I don't have a degree. So when it came to college.
He said, no bachelor's degree.
Yeah, I would have been responsible for more divorce than Facebook or social media in general. But, now, I was one of those kids that didn't really know what I wanted to do. My parents wanted me to go to college really bad. And I, at the same time, I was playing shows with this guy named Corey Smith, who to this day, he'll always be one of my biggest inspirations when it comes to songwriting. He's just an amazing dude, insanely creative, insanely talented, but he took an interesting path. And he was kind of anti-Nashville, anti-label, anti-management, all that stuff. And he was making ends meet, and actually around the same time period he quit teaching and went into music full time. And I was like, man, if I could figure out a way to make ends meet playing my music, that would be amazing. You know, that would be the shit. So that's kind of where my head was at. It wasn't, you know, I remember my parents wanting that plan B and that piece of paper. And I appreciate them wanting that for me now looking back.
So did you end up going to college at all?
I did. I went like a year to Georgia College of State University in Milledgeville.
Yeah.
And then I went like half of a year. I was in college at right there around the house at Gainesville College when I had my wreck.
Right. Okay, gotcha.
And then when the wreck happened, it was kind of around finals and it was just something I didn't go back to.
It was a life-altering situation that you had gone through.
For sure.
I did read somewhere that you had said that you started writing music and that was helping bring your memory back.
Yeah, that and songs that I had written. Mm-hmm. Like, there were things that I was extremely, like, hazy about, especially right after the wreck. But I really didn't notice, like, and again, like, on paper, I've never been to a doctor that told me, you have a TBI. Yeah, this, you know, there's I mean, reasons that you don't remember.
You hit a tree.
Yeah, like, with my head.
Right. I mean, come on, dude. That's like.
Yeah, but it's for brutal. Sure. It's for sure cloudy. It's and you know, it's one of those things too where I think there's probably some things in my past that I've blocked out manually, and you know, it may have been one of those things where it was kind of convenient that some of that didn't come back or that maybe I suppressed some of it, you know, subconsciously just to kind of out of survival or just instinct, you know.
It also probably changed the trajectory of your life, you know.
Absolutely, in a million different ways. And for a long time, you know, I went through this thing where I kind of credited that with making this huge change in my life. Not that it wasn't, but I think that was an easy go-to for me to say, this is where it all turned around. It really gave me an opportunity to go, okay, I was trying the college thing, but life can really be over that quick.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure I'm doing something that I love. And I think when my parents, I remember before my papa died, it was not a popular choice within my family to try to do the music thing and actually pursue it as, you know, a credible means of making a living.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't as easy. I feel like you guys are like the OGs and had to really work to fucking get discovered. Whereas you fucking make a TikTok, get millions of views, and they give you a fucking record deal. Like then, that's not how it was.
Not at all. And you know, we played, we came up the old school way too, where we played the smallest rooms. I mean, VFWs, motorcycle clubhouses.
When I got with Jay, there was one show that we did, and I think 10 people were there. And he rocked that fucking stage like there was 10,000.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Our goal was to go, and if those 10 people showed up, it was to turn them into street teams, right? We want to make sure we come in and The only time I got in trouble with this is I was pretty confident at one point in time, and I remember telling this dude that owned Rick's in Mississippi. I was like, dog, you bring us in the first time, it may not be sold out, but the next time we come.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the only time I ever said that it didn't happen. Because we had a really good team from the beginning. I wasn't a guy that said, all right, well, if I'm going to do this music thing, I need a manager, I need a label, I need this, that, and other. I was coming up watching this dude, Corey Smith, that was doing it without all that.
Right.
So my goal was to do everything I was capable of doing on my own without, you know, giving money away and responsibility away.
Money
and control
that you probably weren't really making because back then it was like just little.
I remember doing it for a long time, having to have, you know, a job on the side, maybe even doing a little dirt to kind of make ends meet, because there were nights
maybe,
when I got paid,
not.
And I paid the band, you know, we'd pay our expenses, and I'd pay the band, and there wouldn't be shit left. A lot of times, paying the band was out of pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that's how it was with Jay in the beginning, just watching him. Literally, he would perform and pay everybody and have nothing left over.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how he toured for like the first, I think, year and a half that we were together. It was just like just to get his name out there and just tour.
It's tough. You're giving everything away.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about your debut album, Modern Day Prodigal Son.
Yeah. I sound like a baby on that. It's wild.
I'll have to listen to it.
Yeah, it's I literally sound like I was 12. I recorded that record at a praise and worship. There was a praise and worship band that had a studio in Winder, and it's where Corey Smith cut his first record.
Is Corey Smith still known? Why does that name sound familiar?
Yeah, so he has a song called Wishing I Was 21. It was really big, but he lit up in college markets. And
I think Jay listens to him.
Yeah, and he's still got some great stuff coming out. He still lives at home in Jefferson, and he's just an incredible dude. But Corey is one of those that I think they... You know, there was some outside pressure to do the Nashville thing at some point, and
right.
He was dead set against it. And then when it came time that he kind of needed to, you know, to grow and kind of access some of those things, it was just something I think in his space, his creative space, and where he works the best is what he's doing now. But he's starting to do some co-writes and stuff, and
yeah.
I'm excited about that for him because. You know, listening to that guy's songs, he was the guy that showed me, you know, between him and Skynyrd, he showed me that it was cool to write about home.
Yeah.
And to describe like little things that, you know, he talked about 129 and I was like, man, that's the road that runs right past my house. You know, like that.
It was just relatable.
Right.
Yeah.
In a major way. And it, you know, I'll never forget that. And that's something I do in my songs to this day.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy how songs that you write, you think are the least relatable and the closest to the chest, like,
end up going platinum.
Yeah, and just end up resonating with people.
Yeah, just well, like, it's I just feel like it's real.
Yeah, that, and I feel like when the delivery is different. You know, when you hear a song, you can tell if a motherfucker believes it or not.
Absolutely.
Or if he's just mumbling along to some shit he thinks is going to make money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a difference in it. And, you know, looking back, I can tell you there were times, and you can hear it on the albums I did, there were songs on albums that I put out that I'm not a huge fan of. I can tell you a lot of the radio singles that we had were my least favorite songs on the project.
Was that because of signing a record deal, you feel like you maybe lost a little bit of creative control and they were pushing more of the radio hits?
Maybe not so much creative control, because that was always something that Scott and the label's been really good about allowing me to retain.
Oh, good.
But we also showed up in town with a little bit of bargaining power, a little more than most, because we were selling out really decent-sized rooms that a lot of these labels had artists going to those same venues that couldn't sell them out.
Is that when your second album was re-released that you started getting that notoriety?
That was around the Hell on Wheels. Yeah, that was the Halfway to Heaven record was when some of that started kicking in.
Yeah. I saw that you had worked with Average Joe Entertainment and then like Colt Ford and all them. And then you ended up they re-released the second album from Big Machine or Valor Music.
Yeah, we had a distribution deal in place with Average Joe's, and that was my brother Colt Ford.
Yeah, we love Colt. He wants to come on the podcast. We're going to have him on.
He's the man.
He's an OG, man.
I'm telling you, and I told your husband this, and something not a lot of people know about Colt. I've watched that man work as hard, if not harder, than anybody I've seen in this business.
I feel like he gives everybody a chance.
Oh, he does several.
Yeah, like he really just like opens his doors and like isn't a hater.
And
like
it's not reciprocated 9 times out of 10.
Absolutely,
for him.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, he for whatever reason, you know, they told him we can't play this on radio. It's just not. It'll never work.
Yeah.
You know, so he starts singing and kind of developing a singing voice, and the answer was still no. And you know, some of the stuff that gets me, man, is like there's guys, and I'm not gonna call anybody's name or anything, but when anybody's on the road and wants to play golf somewhere, or they know that Colt knows somebody and they want to get in the studio with them, or any of that, he's the first one to pick up the phone. He's the first to put, you know, to make ends, you know, to kind of introduce you to anybody, get your foot in the door anywhere. But, you know, there's
when he
like,
needs it, nobody's there for him.
Yeah. If he calls, when he calls for that favor, when he calls to get on that tour or to just, kind of talk about it, it's like the answer is no.
I hate that.
It's been tough to watch.
The music industry in a whole is fucked, and people don't realize all the politics that go on behind the scenes and stuff like that. I'm pretty vocal about it on here just because I've witnessed it firsthand with Jay, you know. That's why I get so mad when people are like, he's a sellout because he signed a record deal. I'm like, you have no fucking clue what even is going on behind the scenes. Like, you couldn't even, your little pea brain couldn't comprehend it.
No. Yeah. It's, you know, I think a lot of people think it's all red carpet and, you know, that, but it's definitely not that. And I tell you what, it's a different situation for him too, because he came in with bargaining power. He came in with a brand that's already built, right? Mm-hmm. And I can relate to that, because that's kind of how we came to town. We weren't going to sit in offices with the suits, so to speak,
right,
and saying, hey, begging for a deal, please sign me. None of that. It was like, hey, if we figure out a way we can help each other and be, you know, make this partnership mutually beneficial, then let's do it.
Yeah.
But if I'm sacrificing creative control, or I'm having to give you this, that, and other, you know, some of these 360 deals that you see some of these kids signing now,
dude,
are unfucking believable.
Yeah. But I mean, they're just owned, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that everybody thinks that anytime anybody signs a record deal, like that's what they're getting, and they don't realize that, you know, people like you, my husband, other people have opened doors and, like, you know, kind of rewritten the contracts for them to be able to do things that were never heard of before.
Absolutely. We have
trying to like be very choosy with my words.
Yeah, you don't have to, but we have a voice in the room.
Yeah,
you know, in whether it be market share or your brand or how many asses you put in seats, you know, all of that gives you a voice in a room, and your husband's got a loud, you know, one of the loudest voices in the room right now.
Literally, though.
Yeah.
He's so loud.
In more ways than one.
Motherfucker is so loud all the time. I'm like, babe, take it down a notch.
But I got to tell you, watching the CMT Awards and watching him bringing 3 home, I'll be honest with you, I don't really watch. I watched it back to watch him get, you know, where credit was due. But I think that was a victory to a lot of us, man.
Yeah.
I think it was a victory to Colt, to me, to you know, a lot of the guys that, man, came from another world.
He's a street kid.
Yeah, and we call Antioch. I told him, I said, dude, you showed up uninvited. And that's been something that we've said. My manager,
you guys should write a song called Showed Up Uninvited.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, some of the best times I've ever had in life are places I showed up to uninvited.
Yeah. Totally. Well, let's bring it back to your second album that got re-released. You started, that's whenever you ended up getting like Single of the Year, ACM New Male Artist and stuff like that for More Than Miles and You Don't Know Her Like I Do. Like when shit started taking off, take me on that journey.
So You Don't Know Her Like I Do, that was our second single.
Was it written about Amber?
It was. Oh. And I put it out. Check this out. I put it out. This is before she was my wife, but
were you broke up when all
this was? Oh, we were not seeing or speaking to each other at all.
Okay, gotcha.
And that was knew damn well, I'm not going to tell you that it wasn't intentional. I knew that song being on the radio. I knew she was going to hear it.
And, yeah.
You know, that was
No, but how fucking sweet is that?
You know?
Like, how
it's sweet
is that?
And spiteful. I think, you know, it's sweet now that, you know, we kind of got back together and ended up getting married and having kids. And, you
were
know, that,
you
that
in active
sweet.
Addiction during that time?
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of why she kept her distance from you. Can we talk about the addiction a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, from the first time, I don't ever remember. I remember the first time getting hammered. I stole a bottle of Crown out of my buddy's parents' liquor cabinet. And we had a field party. And I think I was 14, maybe. And I remember from the first, I got sick as fuck.
Mm, Crown's fucking just syrupy.
But for whatever reason, I loved it so much it didn't matter. Mm. You know, if you eat food and you get food poisoning from something that, and you don't want to eat that for a while, It was not like that for me. I can tell you from the first time, I do remember this, from the first time I ever got drunk, I took advantage of every opportunity I got to get drunk again. From then until December 18th of 2011.
Wow! So alcohol was your
alcohol. And this isn't something I've been really loud about, but it wasn't just alcohol for me. It was alcohol and opiates, pain pills.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say when I was at my worst, I had a laptop bag. I kept not a handle and not a fifth, but about around like a liter size, whether it was, if I was on a bourbon kick, it'd be two bottles of that. If it was vodka, it'd be two bottles of vodka. If it was, you know, yeah, I went through a Jaeger kick for the longest time.
Oof,
I'd have
like
two bottles
shit.
Of Jaeger, and my pistol sat right in between the two bottles, and then the front pocket had my pills in it. And
I loved a good hors d'oeuvre myself.
Oh, my gosh.
Norco's, hors d'oeuvres, all that shit. Give it to me.
For whatever reason, the lower tab 10 was my pill of choice.
Same. I love the Norcos because they hit you a little harder and they had less aspirin in them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my shit.
But it was like, man, I this is the honest God truth. When it was at his worst, you know, I'd do vodka and orange juice in the morning if I was being seen. But I was probably two bottles every 24 hours between 5 and 20 lower tab 10s or perks or whatever I had. You know, the Adderall, the Vyvanse together. I was doing like 30 milligrams of Adderall and 70 milligrams of Vyvanse.
Goodness.
In a 24-hour period. And then I had the little blues that if I ever felt like I was dumping down a little bit.
Oh, I love a Zanny too.
Buddy.
So
Zanny bars, I had a doctor that gave me 60 buses a month. And I hated them for whatever reason. They brought me down too low. They put me to sleep and...
You can't
the way I
it.
Drank, I never remembered anything, and I didn't like that.
He said, "No, I didn't like that."
Yeah, I didn't like losing. I did not.
Zanny's is where I draw the line,
control.
Right?
and you have to remember too, the dudes that I'm around. And you know, this is at a point in time when, you know, they kind of called me the bad boy of country music, but nobody really knew what was going on behind the scenes.
Well, like, because I feel like it was a different era, and they were trying to keep everything hush-hush.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because behind the scenes, buddy, I mean, I'm telling you, I was running with them dudes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? My life wasn't easy company I was around. So, you know, at the time when I was the most fucked up that I was around people that I really didn't have... Like the Xanax thing, passing out and slurring and all that, that's not an option. You don't hang around them dudes like that.
Right.
You get fucked up like that. So my thing was I kind of had a cruising altitude.
Mm.
And if you didn't know me well, you wouldn't have known that I was messed up at all. You might have known that I had a quick temper and, you know.
You handled it really well.
Masked
it.
It was, yeah, I had a good mask.
Mm.
But under that, man, it was just empty bullshit. I got to a point where I was literally, I remember being like, man, I'm not going to make it to 30. There's no way in hell I'm making it to 30. There's no way in hell I'm getting married or having kids. I'm just not that dude. At one point, I wanted to be an outlaw biker.
Mm.
And that's, you know, I wanted to do my music and I wanted to do that. And,
which is a
even
whole
when I didn't really know what that whole world was about, and you know, that's a story for another day. And to this day, I still have respect for dudes in that world. I still rock with dudes in that world. I got all
the
respect in the world for
they
that.
They run like a well-oiled machine.
Oh yeah, and I mean, dude, it's a different kind of human being. that it takes to really be that dude.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things that I learned with running in those circles was I wasn't that dude.
Mm. What was the defining moment for you to get help and to get sober?
So, like, growing up in church, right, and my papa and my grandfather on my mom's side, but my papa was like, that was my rock. That was the dude. He hung the moon and the stars and all that shit. That was him in my life. And, you know, I was raised to value being a good husband and being a good father one day and, you know, to keep faith close in my life. And I had run myself to a point where none of that was in my peripheral at all. Like, it just wasn't on the map. I remember, you know, it was, it had, my life had turned into a giant party. It was every day, all day. We would go out on the road or be out on the road and be on the way home. And there were a few dudes, buddies that I'd call, and they would make sure there was a party kicking so that when we got home, no matter what time it was, what day it was, or whatever, that there was that we came home from a party to a party.
There was just, I always say it's not a party if it happens every day.
Right.
Literally. So it had to have burned you out.
Oh, for years, man. I'm telling you, for years, it was all day, all night, every day. And I remember one night we got a number one. It was number one party for Countrywide. This is our first number one at country radio.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to celebrate, right? And I realized somewhere in the course of all this happening that I wasn't celebrating. It was just another day at the office. And this is something that people have worked their whole lives to and devote, you know.
Yeah.
People go broke and homeless trying to accomplish this huge feat. And we did it. And I couldn't even celebrate it because it wasn't a celebration. It was just another party.
Right.
It was just another night. It's kind of... It's another day at the office.
Right.
And I remember going to the back lounge of the bus I was on at the time and sitting there. And again, this is during the time, too, where, you know, my mind was a little wild. And I just remember sitting back there. And for whatever reason, I had a moment of clarity. And I was like, let me preface this by saying this came right on the heels of me being, I was hospitalized twice in like a few month period. There was some internal stuff. The second time was like, I woke up and I'd got to a point where about every 2 or 3 hours when I'd go to bed at say 2, 3, 4 in the morning, if I went to bed at 3, I'm waking up at 5 and I'm shaking. And I kept that bag went everywhere I went. And it, at this point in time, my bed was on a hot tub. what we called the compound. There's a guy named Mike Deke who passed away a couple of years ago, and a man that I love with my whole heart. I called him Uncle Mike, and he basically built a new house, and they let us live in their old house that they brought their family up in. It was a big house, and we kind of cut it up into apartments.
Oh, okay.
And I stayed in the pool house. So there was a hot tub in there, and I just kind of built a frame for a bed, you know, on top of the hot tub. That hot tub never had water in it. It was slap full of guns.
Oh, my God.
I had two Harleys parked in the bedroom and shit. And,
the ultimate bachelor pad.
Oh, dude, I'm telling you. There was literally at any given day of the week, no joke, you could pull up and walk down that breezeway, and there were probably naked people in the pool and people funneling stuff. I mean,
nice.
just partying non-freaking stop.
Mm-hmm.
And my, you know, we all lived there, half the guys, my head of security, PJ, manager at the time, Steve Tussman, who's, you'll meet Steve before it's over. I can't wait till you do too. Steve's been with me since 2006, and he is literally my right hand.
Like, I love that.
If something happens to him, my right arm's gone.
Mm.
And a big piece of my heart. He's an amazing dude that's been an amazing asset to our organization. But the compound days, this is right before I got sober. I remember one night we flew home private. We were at an end-of-tour party. It was the Willie Nelson Throwdown Tour. It was us, Jamie Johnson, Willie, Lee Bryce, Randy Houser, Lucas Nelson, and all of us were not sober. No. We were all in chapters of our life where we were all trained.
I don't think Willie's been sober for like 50 years.
Right. But he was, this is still, Willie was, he would roll up pretty much, walk off the bus, play the show, get back on the bus, and they'd roll out.
Right.
There were a couple nights he hung out and we got to smoke with him. That was cool. Nicest dude ever.
No. And we get to meet him. Jay's playing a show with him, so I can't wait.
Oh, no joke.
Yeah.
He's the best.
Yeah.
An unbelievable soul. But we were at this after tour party, and there was a little bit of a situation. I've never quit a tour in my life. But this is right in the middle of my bullshit. We went to this after tour party, and there was a dude doing some shit in there that I didn't really like. And I had a couple of my road dogs with me, and he's kind of messing with his chick. And long story short, the idea was I went and asked him if he wanted to smoke a cigarette with me, and we was just going to step outside, you know, kind of leave him in a pool of his own shit. But they stopped it before that happened, broke it up, and one of the people on that tour was screaming at me and said, "We knew you were going to do this. We knew you were nothing but a thug," and this, that, and other. And I was like, "Well, hold on, a thug?" I've been called a lot of shit in my life. That's the first time I've been called a thug. So I remember calling, I had a guy out with me at the time. His name was Darren Glenn. He used to be the police chief in our small town, but he had retired. He was out working with us and kind of trying to, this was at a point where I knew I had a problem,
right?
So he was kind of out. He came to the hospital the first time I was hospitalized and my parents were in there. And anyway, long story short, I said, "Call Scott," meaning Scott Borchett, my record label president.
Right.
And he said, "It's 2 a.m. I said, "Call him." He didn't answer. Well, I go up to the bus and I'm stewing and I'm wanting to fight pretty good. And I see him come running across this open field, and it's like his phone's got some disease he's scared to catch from it. And he was like, "Did you really call Scott?" I was like, "Hell yeah, give me a phone." I got on and he said, I'll never forget his voice. He said, "Hey, B." Like real calm, real nice, and it was the opposite of where I was at. My energy was fucking ready to
tear shit up.
Oh yeah. And it kind of disarmed me for a minute. And I was like, "Man, I ain't this guy, and I ain't one to quit anything, but this woman just called me a thug, and I wasn't, you know, I didn't have any intentions of doing anything. That dude deserved to have his ass whipped, this, that, and that." And he goes, "B, okay, listen. If you'll play this one last show," it hadn't clicked to me that this was the end of tour party. We only have one show left.
Right.
So I'm trying to leave him hanging for one show. He said, "If you'll do that, I'll send the jet to take you and your guys home." Well, I had never been on a private jet before. Mm-hmm. My redneck ass buddies hadn't neither, you know. It sounded like a pretty good deal. The first deal I'd done with him was worked out pretty good. So I was like, "All right, deal." So we flew home that night and we partied like hell the whole way there. And we got home and I remember I had some friends that lived with me at the time. We'll say that. And I was in the bed, and every night, like I said, I'd wake up about 2.5 hours, 3 hours, and I'd be shaking, and I'd just reach over, like it was muscle memory, reach over my bed, pop a couple tabs, chug that liquor bottle, you know, where it bubbled like 3 or 4 times. It literally, when I tell you I drank liquor like water, it was literally like reaching over where you might wake up, dry mouth or something, get a bottle of water.
Yeah.
It was liquor.
Wow.
And, you know, I'd sit there and watch freaking Major Payne or some bullshit movie.
You're lucky you didn't go into like cirrhosis.
Well, this is where, so that night, usually I would be about, I would finish the second bottle for my 24 hour. And dude, I'm telling you, this was a system. Like every 24 hours I'd start every new day, I had 2 new bottles for that day.
Right.
And usually the second bottle, I would finish it in the middle of the night.
I couldn't imagine.
I remember bottoming the bottle out, and the sun not being up, and I knew something was off. So instead of waking up every couple hours and taking sips, I was waking up a lot more frequently than I thought. And while I'm sitting there trying to figure out, I knew something wasn't right. I noticed, just kind of came to me, and keep in mind, at this point, I'd probably popped 6 to 8 Lortabs in the last 12 hours, and I'm hurting. and you know, in like my stomach area, and like I immediately it started hurting more and more and more, and within 30 seconds of being like kind of waking up, I told people that were with me, hey, somebody call my parents and somebody else get me in the fucking truck. I gotta go to the hospital. Something's wrong. And I had pancreatitis. My pancreas was swelling to the point it was seeping. My liver was jacked up. Kidneys were jacked up. And I knew it was bad when I woke up in the hospital and my biker, I call them my biker dads, were there, but Coop and Pop. And I was to a point in my life where in really my later teen years, I think it was probably like this, but my parents had got to a point where they really just couldn't do shit with me.
Right.
There really wasn't a damn, I mean, so it's, long story short, I knew when things got real bad, if they really needed to get my attention, Pop and Coop would show up. And I woke up and they were standing there with the doctor and I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I fucked up now.
Did you end up going to rehab?
They told me that day, and they were both pissed. And usually Pop will get pissed at you before Coop will. But they were both, I could tell they were concerned and they were serious, and there was no bullshit going on in that room. And I remember Pop's telling the doctor, like, ma'am, I need you to tell him exactly what you just told us. Don't sugarcoat it. Tell him exactly. And she looked at me and she said, Brantley, if you don't start drinking, and I interrupted her. I said, yeah, I know. I won't make it to 30. But in my mind, like I said earlier, like I was already to the point where I didn't plan on making it to 30. Right. Like I'm already very familiar. I'm at peace with that. I'm good with it, you know. And she said, no, you won't make it to your next birthday. And this was like November, and I think my birthday was in January. So like months. She said, if you do not quit now, like this is gonna kill you. You're in bad shape.
So and they kept all this hidden from the public.
They had tried, and when I tell you that we have built a family through the years, and I had good people around me, I got fucked up and into my situation in spite of that. They're not enabling at this point. There were times when I'd get pissed off at them, they'd get hiding my liquor bottles from me. So you know, then I'm to a point where I've got stashes here, there, and everywhere, airplane bottles.
I have a feeling nobody's going to be able to tell you no.
And that, at the end of the day, it was like, okay, well, if, you know, I know you're looking out for me. If you don't give me my shit, we're going to fight. But,
I had homies like you growing up.
Right? It was like, I mean, I'm going to do what I want to do until it kills me. And that's for whatever reason. You know, that's been kind of a repetitive theme in my life. Something doesn't get my attention until it damn near kills me.
Yeah. We're just hard-headed like that.
Yeah, so Darren had come out on the road, and I was trying to slow my drinking down a little bit. And he got to where he would mix drinks for me and kind of give them to me as the day went along. But to be honest with you, probably 30, I don't even know if it was a month into that. Like, I was already hiding bottles. And,
well, you had a real addiction.
Oh, yeah, buddy. I was hooked. And but for whatever reason, that night, I had a moment of clarity, and I was like, man, you know, I really kind of need to the things that I'm pursuing in my life are not, they're not filling this gigantic hole. There's a hole somewhere. Something's broke. I'm leaking.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't know how to stop the bleeding. Well, I do know how to stop the bleeding. It's just whether or not I'm willing to do it.
Right.
I didn't want to go to rehab. I'd been kind of, whether it was court appointed or a judge had kind of, you know, or an attorney had told me, hey, this would look good if you, we'd probably do a little better in court if you went to this program or this program. I'd done day partials, you know, where you go like half a day and then go home. I'd been admitted, for, you know, the 30 day stuff, 45 day. And I didn't want to do that. I was dead set against it. But for whatever reason, I had some good people looking out for me that kind of insisted that I go and medically detox at a rehab facility. And I went to Cumberland Heights here in, outside of Nashville. And, man, I remember for like the first 5 or 6 days. And I told them, like, look, I got 20 days and I've got to be on the Eric church, blood, sweat, and beers tour. I'm not fucking missing that, no matter what. So everybody agreed.
You're such a fucking hell on heels. Like, okay, I'm going to go get sober, but it's under my terms and in this amount of time.
And I'd research the kind of medications I thought I needed when I left. And no shit, this is no joke. I think I made 12, 13 days, maybe 15. At one point, I was ready to leave. Once I got out of the medical wing, so the first 3-4 days, no joke, for 3-4 days, I crawled from a bed to a shower and back. Couldn't sleep, couldn't, it was, man.
The withdrawals. Awful.
Fucking torture. Like,
they don't, when you're in a, I don't know for sure, but I just want to kind of explain this for everybody at home. Whenever you're doing a medical detox, do they make you actually detox and they don't make you comfortable at all?
Mm-mm.
Wow.
They do. So they'll keep you from having a seizure, right?
Right.
But I actually, and this was kind of part of the deal for me, I wanted to kind of embrace some of that suck. I wanted it to suck.
So that you,
it had to get my attention.
Go back, yeah.
And I mean, every thought that you could think of. I remember at one point being in there and being like, when I knew that I was going fucking crazy. I remember I had this thought like, man, what if we go play like a charity or show or something in Africa? One, I've got to fly there. Two, what if I get attacked by like a lion? And something clicked in my brain and went, okay. We're fucked up. Like, yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, that was like self-realization. You were like, holy shit.
Couple french fries short of a Happy Meal over here. Need to figure this out. But yeah, I went in, and once I got out of the medical wing, like in my mind, I was like, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, as long as I had it lined up where a buddy of mine, it was a paramedic, was going to come on the road with us in case I had a seizure and all that. When I called to tell him I was ready to go, everybody disagreed with me to the point where they sent Pop yeah. and his wife came down on a motorcycle.
Is Pop still around?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah,
that's my dude.
Shout out, Pop.
Yeah, Pop's the man. But him, my mom came up there, my dad came up there, and, you know, I was telling them, just like I was telling everybody else, I'm fucking leaving. Like, yeah. You know, I'm did what I came to do. I've made a decision that that's not going to be part of my life anymore, and, you know, this, that, and other, and, but they sent Pop down there, and he bought him a couple more days. But I think it was like between day 10 and day 15. I remember, yeah, it would have been. So I went in there on December 18th, and I know I was in there for New Year's. Mm. I remember my mom brought me like some Christmas presents to rehab.
Aww. We that's love mama. Mom.
Yeah, that's mama. But they came up, taught me to stay in a couple of days. But the day I finally told them, I was like, all right, and they knew they couldn't keep me in there anymore. Like, I'm coming out. I need to go to a doctor's office because there's a couple things I need to make sure. And I'd already talked to the doctor ahead of time. He was in touch with my doctor in the facility.
Mm-hmm.
So Scott Borchetta and my manager at the time, Rich Egan, picked me up from rehab, took me to the doctor's office, and then dropped me off at the bus. And we went and did the Eric Church Blood, Sweat, and Beers tour in 2012.
Did you stay sober?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I went about a year, year or two with nothing at all. And then I kind of started dabbling in the pot a little bit.
Right. I don't think there's anything wrong with weed.
You can't convince me. Man, here's the thing. Like, I want to be careful with this, though, because there's tons of people watching this that... Y'all, we're all built different, right?
Right,
every single, we're as different as our fingerprints. All of our rock bottoms are different. All of our vices operate differently. And addiction, mm-hmm. being the demon that it is going to attack you in your most vulnerable place and in different ways. So I don't encourage anybody to, mm-hmm. especially if you're an addict, and I am an addict. I'm an addict's addict.
Absolutely.
Like, if I find anything I like, I'm going to do it till it hurts me, mm-hmm. you know? But for whatever reason, with pot, that's not the case. Like, I could smoke, and I could go a week without smoking. I could go a month without smoking. Right. I was trying to get life insurance at one point, and I went off for like 2 months and didn't need it. They still didn't give me fucking life insurance. But
what?
I'm a liability. Yeah.
That is crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're not wrong.
I think insurance is the biggest fucking scam, but that's a whole nother fucking conversation.
Yeah. But yeah, I came out, and man... It was pot. I never smoked when I drank. I did from time to time, but I didn't like.
You get the spins whenever you drink and smoke. I don't like it.
It just made me tired.
Yeah.
And in my mind, like, if I'm tired and something bad happens, we got to run from the law. We got to fight somebody, or we got to run for whatever reason. I don't want to be stumbling. I don't want to be sleepy.
Yeah.
I need to go.
Absolutely. So, so you stayed sober the whole Eric Church tour. Did you and Amber start talking again? Because you guys got married in 2015, right?
So on June 16th of 2014, I got a call from my cousin, who was the guy that was the youth pastor at that church.
Yep.
He and his wife, he's blood family to me, but they were really close with Amber and had been her whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And Amber and I both, now when we split up for those 5 years, we both went our separate ways. We were both in different relationships, and mine was rather brief. I really wasn't, to be completely honest with you. I wasn't good at relationships. Mm-hmm.
You didn't love yourself, so how are you able to love somebody else or have somebody else love you the way you needed to be loved?
And the environments I was in were not tailor-made for girlfriends or any of that. I knew I was a whore. You know what I mean? It's like, for whatever reason,
hound
I don't
dogging.
Know why, my conscience is fucked up like this. Like, I could, if a man did the right thing, I could put a bullet in him and put him in a ditch and be all right with it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I cheated on my wife, I'd probably call her and have to tell her, like, the minute it happened. For whatever reason, my conscience is fucked up in that space.
And that's so good,
I'm thankful
though.
For that, right?
A lot of people wouldn't know that about you, though. You know, like, they would just be like, oh, he's probably just like all these other people. And like,
no,
you know?
That's a weird thing to me. And even when I was in a relationship, and anybody around me that knows the way, I could tell you this. If I was in a situation with somebody where we had decided we weren't seeing other people, now I could count those on one hand for my entire life. But when I was in those situations, I was not one to
stray,
do all that other. But I knew that, and for that reason, that's why I stayed out of relationships. Right. Amber, for whatever reason,
it's had a hold on you.
And even the girls that I was in relationships with or whatever they were, you know, I didn't have many girlfriends and, you know, any of that stuff. But even when I would try to move on or date somebody, I was always really upfront about, hey, this is my life, and I'm cool where it's at.
Right.
We can hang out, that kind of thing. I was never one of those shady dudes. It was like, I'm on, you know, let's get married and run off kind of thing, or try to get somebody to bed like that. It was never, I was always straight up honest and all that. But for whatever reason, from the time I met Amber, there was just something. It was she was what I couldn't have, and then she was the one that got away. And when she moved on and went her separate way.
So you taunted her for years.
I don't know if I haunted her. She haunted the fuck out of me. And, you know.
No, I said taunted because you bought the property down the street from her mom.
Oh, yeah.
Wrote songs about her on the radio.
Put songs on the radio.
She's like, everywhere I go, I can't fucking just, this guy will not go away.
But I will say this. I got to a point to where I knew she had moved on. And she was doing, you know, and she had made a commitment to somebody else, and I respected that.
No.
Because I was like, dude, you know, it was the one girl I loved in my life enough to say, all right, well, if that's your forever, then I'm going to leave you to it, and I'm going to go do mine. And mine's real fucked up. But, you know, it was one of those things. And that's one of the things I think that allowed me to kind of dive into some of those more some of the rough crowd scenarios. Is like, dude, I'm not getting married, I'm not having kids. If it ain't that one, it's probably not gonna work. Especially after the you know, I had a relationship, it was a loud one because we were both in the business. Even when that was going on, I think she knew that there was a piece of me that was still with that other, and she also knew there was a piece of me that was just a fucking renegade, man. Like, rebel. I want to be moving. When I was single, no joke, I very seldom went home. We get done with a show, and if I didn't have to be anywhere the next day, we may go bounce down to a clubhouse in Florida, or we may go bounce to the Chicago clubhouse and visit some bikers.
That's why you and my husband are such good friends, because literally you guys are the same, sewn from the same cloth.
Yeah.
He's, I always tell him, I'm like, you're the first to show up and the last to leave.
Yep.
And I'm the opposite. I'm the last to show up and the first to leave.
That's my wife.
Literally.
Yeah. That's my wife.
Well, let's keep moving on. So you and Amber got married in 2015 and then you dropped your fourth album in 2017, The Devil Don't Sleep.
Yeah.
It was known for some really dark themes, I read. Yeah. What was the inspiration for that? Because you were, you'd got married and like, I would think it would be a happy time in your life.
You know, when we got back together, so what I, my best guess about what that was about, I've always tried to be kind of unfiltered and just honest. And when I go into the album making process, like, I try not to give it much of a controlled, intentional narrative.
Right.
Okay. In other words, like, I don't try to paint a picture that's not.
Right.
I try to be where I'm at and also look back at some of the shit I've been through. Because let's be honest, nobody wants to listen to sunshine and fucking butterflies and flowers for an hour and a half. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
There's something about music, that, especially rap music. To me, it's the truest form of expression outside of prayer. In times, has been, you know, can feel even more powerful, knowing it's not. But it's to me, it's just, there's a lot of power in it.
Absolutely.
You know, spiritually.
You move millions with your words, literally. Yeah.
And when you start to kind of wrap your head around that, too, it kind of sends you in some different directions. But I think that's, we're all a little bit weird. If you're an artist, you've got some screws loose, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, for sure. I always tell everybody, being a partner of an artist, you don't realize how eccentric you have to be able to tap into each of those emotions, express them, write a song, sing it, and put it all together. Like, it's a talent.
And if you do it right, relive it every time you sing it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I do think that was some of the, you know, a lot of the songs, I've written songs about things that I don't like having conversations about. And it took me a long time where I was comfortable talking about a lot of stuff
that you had gone through.
Yeah. Just because, well, one, you know, most of my adult life, I spent in circles that you don't really talk a whole lot.
Right.
You know what I mean? You just kind of keep quiet. Your business is your business, because if I start running my mouth and telling a bunch of stories, I'm liable to incriminate you, me, or one of our buddies.
That. But I also feel like men, you guys cannot catch a break when it comes to mental health. You know, like, you guys are not allowed to feel emotions. You're not allowed to be depressed. You're not allowed to be sad. Like, you have to suck it up. As little boys, you're taught to suck it up, you know, and you carry that through life. And so that just, you know, sorry, Chachi.
No, dude,
he's just over here sawing logs. So that just, you know, it follows you through life, and you're just not, you know, you guys literally get shut out as far as it comes to like mental health and to like being able to express yourself.
For sure. I think, you know, the songwriting gave me a kind of a loophole there.
Right.
But I will say, man, you know, there's something about a strong man that was raised that way and has embraced that and knows how to vent and express himself in his own way.
Yes.
While maintaining that tough exterior. I think there's
Absolutely.
Something to that. There's a reason that we look up to those men and want to be like them.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's something in society, I feel like, right now, we need to be careful with. Like, when it comes to my son, totally different in my approach as a parent, right, wrong, or indifferent. My grandmother says I'm too hard on him. My wife,
you and Amber,
I'm
have two kids, by the way.
So. Yeah, Barrett and Bray. And Barrett is just the best hearted little kid ever. Like, you literally, you can see it in his eyes that he just has a giant heart and he's just a kind soul. And that scared the shit out of me worse than if he would have been a hellion from the time he came out, just because, you know,
you didn't want him to get hurt.
Well, that's dangerous in the world we live in today. This world will chew you up and spit you out. And I feel like society right now, we're all on this shit about don't hurt somebody's feelings or don't trigger somebody. This, that, and other. The
everybody
fucking
gets
world
a,
don't work like
everybody
that.
Gets a trophy.
Yeah, it just don't. I'm not on that. And I feel like, you know, some of this, you know, I understand the talking points about toxic masculinity and this, that, and other, but there is healthy masculinity.
Yes, absolutely.
And we have to promote that in these kids. I'm not raising a little boy.
Mm.
I'm raising a man. And I won't, if I have my preference, I'd raise a king.
Yeah.
So I want my son to be a leader.
Yeah.
Like, I want him to have the the fucking moral fortitude and you know, the faith, and I want him to be equipped with all the things he needs to lead people in good directions.
Which he will, because he has you.
I hope so. That's
I think toxic masculinity stems from people who were raised by narcissistic men and stuff like that. And I think it's so rampant because that generation, like, of our parents, they didn't know how to heal. You know, they didn't want to heal, and they were like perpetual victims. So they inflicted their trauma onto their children. So I think that's why toxic masculinity is such a huge thing right now, because there are so many people who were affected by it. But you're right. People need to start talking about the healthy masculinity and like being able to raise your babies. And, you know,
we need men in the world, strong men, masculine men. We need strong women as well. My wife, you know, no joke, I give her a hard time, but dude, and I know this can be kind of a cop out. People say this a lot, but in all reality, I was in the delivery room for both of mine.
Oh, God.
If I'm telling you, if I'm responsible for childbirth, if men are responsible for childbirth, the human race would have been extinct a long fucking time ago.
I don't know how. Listen, shout out to all the moms out there, because that's the reason I don't have biological children. Childbirth scares the living shit out of me.
Well, good, it for is good reason.
Barbaric.
There's a lot that can go wrong. One, which I was terrified about that, but two, it's like, I mean,
it's barbaric.
Oh my God. I mean, I remember looking at it like, dude, you are a fucking soldier. Yeah. Like, looking at my wife, like, I knew you were a badass, but this is on another level. But, you know, my wife's been through some real shit in her life, too. She lost her dad.
No. I wish Amber was here. We could have brought her on.
Yeah. She's funny. But yeah, like, she's an incredibly strong woman. And knowing what I know about you, you're an incredibly strong woman. That's so important in society. But I do think we got to let men be men too.
I agree.
You know what I mean? And I think there's things that are some uncomfortable talking points that people don't want to hear. Like, some of the I feel like it's necessary for some men, me in particular. There's a guy named John Lovell that has a platform called the Warrior Poet Society. And a lot of that's about unapologetic masculinity, faith. But just really about being a good man, a better husband, a better dad, but also being the most dangerous dude in the room. Mm-hmm. Like, as a man, part, you know, and there's a thing on there called the order of man. And this guy talks about there being three responsibilities that we have as men and as head of our households. And I feel like I'm the head of my household, but I feel like I do share that with my wife. I'm gone so much that she
holds it down.
That's the queen. I'm the king, she's the queen, and we rule together.
Yeah.
But he talks about us having three responsibilities, and that's to protect, provide, and preside. You know, and protect is more than just having a gun in your pocket, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I know this is a touchy subject for a lot of people, but I believe in carrying firearms, I believe that responsible gun ownership includes training. Right.
Absolutely.
Just having a dude that goes and buys a gun and sticks it in his pocket and says he's armed is dangerous. Is just as much a liability.
They just passed a law like that, didn't they? Mimi, didn't you just tell me that they just passed a law? They just passed a law where people can just go buy guns without any training.
Yeah. And you know what? Like, my views on that are you know, I feel like most of the people that you would fuck with in life. Right. And I feel like this is the case for me. Or more so kind of middle of the aisle politically. There are a couple things, you know, a couple topics or situations that put them hard on one side of the aisle. And for me, I lean right mainly because of guns.
Right.
And our Second Amendment right being a constitutional right. Like,
Not that I believe we want to get into all that. Yeah, we're not getting political. Yeah. We're just talking about things.
But I do believe that, you know, it is, you know, my responsibility as a husband and as a dad, not just if I'm going to own a gun, I need to know everything about it, how it works.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I need to train, you know, on situational awareness. I need to train tactically. I need to make sure, you know, situationally mainly, because, you know, if you don't know the laws in the states you're in.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And you pull that out, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter what kind of asset you think you are.
No, for sure.
It's going to cost you years of your life and maybe somebody else's life or yours itself.
When we tour, we have to check the laws because of the security mm-hmm. to find out, you know, what we can and can't do with.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, as a dad, I believe that there is a certain part of me that it's almost a responsibility to be dangerous in a sense, to be mm-hmm. capable of violence, to be capable of protecting myself, my friends, my wife and my kids first and foremost.
I believe in violence. My husband doesn't. He tells me all the time I need to calm down because I grew up an extremely violent human too, but I've softened a lot in my years, but I'm the same way.
Yeah.
Pop off, like fuck around and find out.
Yeah. I think it's a necessity to have the capability, you know, just to have the capacity to do violence.
Absolutely.
John talks about being the most dangerous man in the room. It's not just about having that to be intimidating or to make somebody fear you.
Right.
I'm not the one that's going to put my gun on my hip so God and everybody can see it. When I've got my, you've seen mm-hmm. where I carry my, it's right there.
Yeah.
You know, where nobody needs to know I have it.
No.
And
but that's
it's
a real G.
Not coming out, right? No, unless there's a situation that presents itself where there's no other option.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree.
But I spend a lot of time kind of following guys that talk a lot about that stuff and in that space because I do want to be, and I want my son to see, you know, what being a man is really about. And it's mm-hmm. not all rub dirt on it, this, that, and the other. I feel like to be a real man and a real well-rounded man, we not only have to have the capacity to be, maybe vulnerable is an uncomfortable word for me to use, but that may be the word, but you know,
to be vulnerable but tough.
Yeah, like a lion and a lamb,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Is what John says sometimes on his site. It's like we need to be capable of showing love and sympathy mm-hmm. and empathy, and
that's being a real man, being able to show your emotions to the people that you love. That they need to see that. Your family has to be able to see that. So that's
for sure.
A quality of a real man, but also to be able to just be like, you know, the protector, the provider and stuff like that. That's also great qualities of a man too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, I believe that with my whole heart. Cause we were talking earlier about my papa and mm-hmm. you're talking about a man that hung the moon and the stars and everything, like I said, and him and but my mom's dad too, they're both hard men.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't the happy-go-lucky, all smiles all the time.
But you knew that he loved you.
He didn't have to say it.
There you go.
You know, he lived his life. The way he lived said, I love you every time you looked at him. Even if he was whipping your ass.
We
you
love
know, it was out of love, yeah. That was my dude, man.
Well, moving on from 2017, what, you know, like, what is going on now? Like, what is in the plans and the works for you now? Like, what can we expect from Brantley coming up?
Man, you think that you get to a certain point in life and in your career where things start to slow down a little bit, and that has not been the case for me.
yeah, you have had a lot of staying power, which a lot of artists can't do that.
It's a blessing and a curse, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like I'm grinding harder right now. I feel like I'm kind of back in the good old days again. There's not many favors going on right now. We're having to earn or keep, but I appreciate that. I have a respect for that, and it's kind of like the thing where, you know, if somebody gives you a car, you know, you see kids that give their first vehicle given to them, and kids that have to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you, in 5 years, that kid that bought his car, that car's going to be in better shape than the one.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like, so I don't have a problem with working harder for it. What makes that hard is being away from my kids and not being home. I have a 2-week rule, but if I'm being completely transparent and honest, there's some things not sitting right about how much time I've spent away from my kids and how much I've missed.
Would you ever bring them on tour with you?
We do.
Yeah.
If it's close to the house. But see, the thing is, now they're both starting school. Amber's actually doing something pretty cool. It's like I was dead set against homeschooling my kids. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to go to the high school I went to and, you know,
learn social skills and all that stuff.
But the more that I'm seeing about this, you know, some of the things that are being taught, and also
that,
you know, we're looking
shootings.
At these shootings.
Mm-hmm.
I called my wife, and I was talking to a good friend of mine about, it was right after the Uvalde thing happened, and we had been talking about some different options for school, and I got some kind of some details on that shooting that weren't so public that really, man, fucked me up for a week and a half solid. I was mad. Aww. I was worried, scared, but just raging mad.
Any sort of violence towards children is just unacceptable, and it's just hard to stomach. When that just happened here in Nashville, I was watching the news, and I held it all together until I saw those little babies walking out of the school all holding hands, and I fucking lost it. Like, I just started bawling, and I'm not an emotional person like that. So to even see that, I was just like, dude, what is going on in our world?
No, and the justice system isn't able to hand justice out that those motherfuckers deserve, in my opinion.
So is Amber going to homeschool them now? Or?
Amber is a teacher. She yeah, that's what her degree's in teaching, and she was teaching third, fourth, and fifth, right?
That is really hot.
My wife for a teacher, I wouldn't have got shit done in that class. But, right? Hey, girl, teacher got a booty.
Yeah, no, for body.
Fuck, I wouldn't have got a damn thing done. but she had this idea for, it's like a micro school. It's like a homeschool school.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, basically the parents essentially are homeschooling the kids, but they do it through the school. And
right.
I don't want to speak on it too much, as it is her thing. I don't want to take away from it. One, I don't want to explain it wrong.
Right.
But it really started to appeal to me, because I know she'll teach faith there. Mm-hmm. Right. And faith is extremely important to me and kids too. Not so much, I'm not as big on church as some are. As my
religion.
Wife.
Religion. You're not big on religion, but you're big on spirituality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's how I am.
And I have to look at it like this too. Like, my church experience is different. I still live at home in a small town, and when we show up, it can be weird. And I've had some weird church experiences too. Same. But spirituality and faith and believing in God is important to me.
Absolutely.
Especially when it comes to my kids. And I have no doubt they'll make sure that's intact to what they're learning. But I want my kids to learn history. I've got a godson that's 16 years old, has no idea, doesn't know a damn thing about World War II, Vietnam, doesn't know anything about any of the generals or what went down or why it went down.
Because they don't teach that in school anymore.
Right. But and I just think, man, that was one of the most important things I learned was history. And I love history, and it teaches us, right, because it repeats itself indefinitely, but in the worst way. If you're not educated, about it and how things happen, not only does it happen again, it happens again worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I wanted them to learn.
Literally happening right now.
Right.
Yeah, the world is a circle, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And I want, I want my kids to, I want them to learn history. I also want them to learn how to do stuff outside, man. And we've got a new farm that's near the house and near where the school's going to be. And they'll be able to do some stuff there, spend some time outside. But also, these kids are going to be safe.
Yeah, awesome.
Because when I say there's going to be security there, I don't mean we're going to have a little man with a pea shooter on it.
Absolutely. So you just got off tour with Five Finger Death Punch, and you're about to go on tour with Nickelback.
Shit's
Daddy
wild,
Chatty.
Right? Daddy Chatty.
We all love Daddy Chatty here.
Motherfucker's a trip, dude.
I love him. Ever since Jay sent me that video of him, what does he say? Silly bastard. We say that to each other now all the time. If somebody does something, we're like, you silly bastard.
That dude's a fucking trip, man. He'll get me on FaceTime, and it's just fucking wild. That tour is going to be interesting.
I can't wait. We got to come see a show. Like, if our tour is crossed, because when do you guys leave?
I told him, and I'll tell you the same thing. Y'all are welcome anywhere I am.
No.
And if you're not, same. I'll fucking leave.
Aww.
Y'all are family to me, man. And I told you, anytime we cross paths on the road, y'all got a home there. And
when
do you guys
go out?
We leave in June.
Okay, so we'll be right behind you then.
Yeah, we're out for 3 months. It's a long one.
Mm.
It'll probably be the last time I do that.
Yeah.
I'll tour. I'm not saying I'm going to retire from touring after this year, but the 3 month thing away from a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, it's just not something I'm probably going to do again.
Maybe you're just kind of ready to, you know, calm it down a little bit.
I think on that side of things, maybe. Mm-hmm. On the career side of things, I think I feel like there's, in some ways, I'm just getting started. This, you know, your husband and I are working on this project that I'm super stoked about.
Do you have a name for the project yet?
I think we're leaning towards Co-Defendants.
Oh, I love that.
Right? Is this kind of fitting? But I think, you know, we hadn't talked much about it yet. And we kind of spilled a little tea in our own way in some different places, but I mean, this is a good place to talk about it. I've been waiting for a long time for somebody to come into this space with that kind of authenticity. That real, that has seen some shit. And I'm telling you, when we walked in, I was a fan, but when I walked in the room and we shook hands, well, already we parked in the parking lot of the studio. And there's dude standing outside. I know now it was Boston.
Oh, he always travels with security.
Yeah, another dude standing out there. And I look at these dudes, and I ain't going to say anybody's name or nothing, but, you know, when you spend some time around the right kind of company, you know eyes.
Yeah, you know what's going on.
And literally, I was like, okay. So, dude, I get it. And I walked in, and the minute we looked at each other, I feel like I'd known him all life. Like, I just knew the dude.
He loves you.
To have a heart like he's got in a past that go hand in hand together, and to be able to do what he's done and use that as a weapon against evil, man, to me is something to behold. Mm. And not to take anything away from any other artist in this, but I'm not saying that he's the only real one on the block right now. Everybody goes through real shit, right?
You guys just are friends, you know?
Yeah, we're friends. But I do think that, man, that when it comes to being real, I feel like there's an obsession right now in society that people are just obsessed with being real.
Yeah.
99% of them have no fucking clue what that
means.
Those
that claim it ain't it.
Right?
I've always said that.
It's like, dude, your husband, you don't hear your husband telling nobody that. I mean, I'm giving him credit where credit's due. Yeah. You know? His track record speaks for itself.
No, he's.
But the things your husband's proud of, mm-hmm. and the things he talks about, and the things he's writing songs about the uncomfortable stuff too. Mm-hmm. But in conversation with him and knowing where his life's at, what his intentions are with his wife and the people around him, like, that's what makes it special to me.
No.
You know, you can. There's real songwriters in every room. There's real artists everywhere in this town, but. When you're able to take not so pleasant experiences and use them to help other people and to make change.
Yes.
I love him because he's making waves and no doubt I get excited. Anytime somebody comes on the scene that I can tell is fishing to rock the boat some.
Yeah.
I start getting excited.
Yeah. Dude, CMT is just embracing, you know, the country music. First of all, I married a fucking rapper, okay? My husband pulled the biggest okie doke in the world on his own wife. So we are now thrust into the fucking country world, and they love him. It's either they love him or they are so confused. And I love it because it keeps people talking. You know,
yeah,
they don't
let
know
them
what's
be confused.
Going on. Yeah. So do you have an album coming out? Anything like that you want to plug before we get out of here?
April the 21st, we've got the deluxe coming out of
he's looking at his manager right now.
So help me God, the deluxe edition is coming out April 21st. I'm actually going home today, but I'm coming back in 3 days, and your husband and I are jumping in the studio for another week.
I'm excited about that. You guys always make magic, so I'm excited to see what you guys do.
And this round's going to be a motherfucker. So
Son of the Dirty South did great.
That. Oh, and it's still doing.
Yeah.
We're still making it. I play that fucker till the day I die. I love it. So.
Yeah, love it.
I'm looking forward to that project. I know he's got some stuff coming out too. And, you know, another thing about getting into y'all's world that's been interesting is I've actually been introduced to some folks in Struggle and Adam Calhoun. And
I love A-Cal.
Oh, dude, man.
He's the best.
I'm telling you. Him and Struggle both. I have a
deep
respect
for both. I don't know
about Struggle,
but
I know.
I'm just kidding, Strug.
But y'all are good now, right?
Yeah, we're good.
But yeah, totally I think kidding, the world Struggle. Of both of them dudes. And I know they got some stuff going on. And Man, that's exciting to me, man. I feel like everything that's going on in our little camp right now in our little family is exciting.
You guys are like building a kind of like your own, I don't want to say genre, but your own like
whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah, like we can't put it in a box, you know, but it's different. It's still country, but it's completely different, and it's just you guys, it's outlaw shit.
You know, the last time that happened and worked was when Shooter's Pops.
Yeah.
And his buddies did it, and they did it right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you guys are really onto something here.
Yeah, so. And here's the thing. All gas, we're not no trying breaks. To be Waylon and Willie, and, no. and it, but it's a totally different thing. And I do think if it's unapologetic, if we go about it the right way, man, the world loves outlaw, but the world needs outlaws.
Absolutely.
You got to have us. Those of us that live outside the box are what gives you your fucking box.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And absolutely. I feel like we can own that space and have a lot of fun doing it. So, man, I'm stoked about that.
Love that.
Stoked about being a dad and hubby and getting on the road. The Nickelback tour is going to be awesome. And I think we've been in some talks about playing some more shows together.
Good.
Coming up.
Yeah, well, Manili just walked in, too, so we can talk to him.
Yeah!
Manili's
the
in here somewhere.
The fuck's up, my dude?
Well, Brantley, thank you so much for coming by, babe. I appreciate
you so
much.
Thank you for having
me, darling.
I appreciate it. What do you know?
Why don't you tell people where they can find you, all your socials? I'm sure they already know where you are, but just show them out.
Oh, yeah. I can't get nobody my address. I show up like a crazy bitch from Texas. My manager's in the room. Give me all the shit. They don't, all right, so I'll tell you this.
You can come in here.
This may disappoint some people, but yeah, I don't even have the fucking password to my social media.
What's
they
his
don't trust
website
me with it.
To send everybody to?
BrantleyGilbert.com.
BrantleyGilbert.com. If you need anything, what are you, Brantley Gilbert on Instagram? Brantley Gilbert on TikTok.
I'm the same dude everywhere.
There, just Google Brantley Gilbert and you'll find him.
Come on.
I can't wait to have you back, Brantley.
Let's
do
it again.
Yeah, baby. Thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of Dumb Blonde. I will see you guys next week. Bye. Doesn't he remind you of Bussy? That's our Basset Hound.